Lynn Markham is your presenter today. Lynn is a land use specialist with CLU. Her extension work focuses on zoning and board of adjustments and appeals and land use tools and techniques to assist communities. Lynn provides research-based information policy options and community case studies. She has written several publications on shoreland zoning and is co-author of the Zoning Board Handbook. Becky is your co-presenter today. She is also a land use specialist with CLU. She provides training workshops for plan commissions and other local land use officials. She also assists communities with comprehensive planning, public participation, plan implementation, and the fiscal impacts of land use decisions. Becky is the author of the Plan Commission Handbook and co-author of the Zoning Board Handbook and Land Use Megatrends. Lynn is now ready to begin the webinar.
Lynn, if I could ask quickly, somehow the screen share that you have has changed. So we're seeing a bit more. Yeah, there you go. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. Alrighty, good morning and welcome to our webinar. Thanks for joining us. My name is Lynn and I'll be presenting today's webinar. Before we get started on variances, I wanted to share these upcoming webinars. We have a webinar coming on November 30th by Becky that will be refreshing your zoning ordinance. And we're also planning on doing more planning and zoning webinars this coming winter. Speaking of which, we would like your input on which topics you're most interested in, which webinar topics you might attend. So if you could, I need to set up the poll.
So Lynn will go ahead and launch the poll while I read the question. Right. Which of these additional webinar topics would you like to see in the future? And you can select multiple options. You should see a pop-up menu to select this. So some of the options that we've included here are zoning fundamentals, comprehensive planning, shoreland zoning, subdivision regulations, public participation, meeting and hearing conduct, and reconsidering one dwelling unit per parcel. If you have additional suggestions, you're welcome to find the chat box and include those there. You can also reach out to any of the presenters today and suggest items by email as well.
We'll give you a minute here to finish your voting. Looks like shoreland zoning is fairly popular, as well as reconsidering one dwelling unit per parcel are in the lead, but there are a number of these that we may offer in the future. We appreciate your input on what you would find interesting. Okay, it looks like most people have entered theirs. Oh, a little bit more jumping around. Okay, I am going to end this poll so we can continue. Thank you. All right. So starting on zoning for today, I'm not going to review zoning in general. If you didn't make it to our webinar, it was the end of August. It was Introduction to the Zoning Board, the Role of the Zoning Board. Karen put that link that includes the video in the chat box that is available if you missed that. So I'm going to assume that you know most of the basics of zoning, but I just want to very briefly talk about the two parts of a zoning ordinance. So there's a map, a zoning map, that shows the various districts, residential, industrial, commercial, conservancy, and then a text that goes with the map that first of all talks about what is the purpose of that zoning ordinance, what are the uses for each district, dimensional standards such as lot size, density, setback, and so forth, as well as other requirements that could include parking and signage. It's also important to be aware that there are overlay zoning districts. An overlay zoning district is a special zoning district that applies in addition to the base zoning district. So what you see here near the middle of the map, this WP is an overlay zone that stands for wellhead protection. There both the R1 residential zoning district and the wellhead protection standards would apply. Okay, moving on to the types of decisions that are made. We have three types of decisions in local government. We have legislative decisions that only need to meet two criteria. They need to be constitutional, and they also need to be reasonable. There's a high level of discretion in legislative decisions made by a county board, a common council, a village or town board. Secondly, we have quasi-judicial decisions, and that's where variances fit in. Discussion is limited to during the hearing, and predetermined standards apply. Conditions can be crafted and added as well. And then we have administrative decisions. These are applying the ordinance standards as written, and there are no additional conditions. So our quasi-judicial decisions, including variances, are here in the middle and have some flexibility, but they're also limited in terms of their discretion. I want to take just a moment and point out some of the components of the image above as they apply to zoning boards. The zoning board members apply the laws shown by the thick books, which are Wisconsin statutes here. Also the code of ordinances, your local ordinance, which includes the zoning ordinance. And then we show a notebook here. And that's for capturing your thoughts during the hearing on the evidence that's presented by the applicant, by the staff, by anyone else, neighbors who present at the hearing. And in the back is a cup of coffee, which for some of us is helpful. I want to just touch briefly on terminology. While boards of adjustment and boards of appeal do the same thing in Wisconsin, they do have different names. So counties and towns that do not have village powers have what are called boards of adjustment. And cities, villages, and towns with village powers have boards of appeal. Different names, same function. Both are referred to, both the Board of Adjustment and Board of Appeal are referred to often as the Zoning Board or the BOA. Some people will call it the ZBA or the BOZA, but it's important to know that these names, Zoning Board, BOA, ZBA, are different from the Zoning Committee. The Zoning Committee is a subset of the elected officials, and they make recommendations on how to change the zoning ordinance, whereas the BOA makes decisions on specific properties and whether variances should be granted. So, kind of to illustrate the difference, here on the left, we have elected officials that would adopt the zoning ordinance or amend the zoning ordinance, and they're representing their constituents, their elected officials. And that's different from the BOA members. They act like judges. They apply the ordinance and the state laws as written. It's not always easy to say no to neighbors who want an exception, a variance to the zoning ordinance. So one of the things we recommend is to let applicants know that the BOA is required to follow the local ordinance and state laws. They can't decide whatever they would like to decide. And only elected officials can change the law. The BOA can make recommendations on changing the law.
Lynn, I have a question for you that I hear quite often. This is especially common in small communities where it's difficult to find zoning board members. Is it okay to have overlap between your elected officials and your zoning board?
Sure, good question. It's not illegal, according to Wisconsin law, to have elected officials serving on the BOA. However, we recommend against that, against having elected officials on the BOA for a couple of reasons. It can create a conflict of interest when you have a variance applicant who's also a constituent of an elected official. And the second thing is BOA members, because they're acting like judges, need to be unbiased. And a BOA member can't claim that they're unbiased if they've previously voted for or against adoption of the zoning ordinance or an amendment to that ordinance. They've already weighed in and said whether they're in favor of that or not. Thanks, Becky. Okay, so the zoning board functions like a court. The zoning board must follow a number of different sets of law, state statutes, case law, which is court decisions that set precedent, and local zoning ordinances. The zoning board has to apply these laws to particular fact situations in order to make quasi-judicial decisions, decisions like a judge. And they must apply the laws as written. If what you want to do is change the local zoning ordinance, our recommendation is that you run for office, because it's the elected officials that have the authority to change the zoning ordinance. Like I mentioned, zoning boards can recommend changes, but they can't make changes to the ordinance. Because the zoning board functions like a court, their decisions can be appealed to the higher courts, typically first to Circuit Court, then the Court of Appeals, and then the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And if the zoning,
because the zoning board functions like a court, their decisions
can be appealed to higher courts. Sorry about that.
Then the Court of Appeals, and then the Wisconsin
Supreme Court. I clearly have a recording going.
If the zoning board followed state statutes,
I think I'll just go to the next one. I think you have that in your PowerPoint that's on the additional resources page. Okay, fairness and due process. So not having bias is illustrated, or being unbiased is illustrated, by the blindfolded justice here holding a set of scales. The blindfold represents the impartiality or being unbiased, and BOA decisions shouldn't depend on whether or not a BOA member likes the applicant. Instead, the set of scales illustrates how the BOA weighs or evaluates the evidence presented for and against a proposal during the hearing. The toga shown here, worn by the justice, has no pockets. The idea there is there's no place to hide anything. Briefly, open meetings law as it applies to zoning boards. Zoning boards must comply with the open meetings law, and closed sessions are limited by statutes. Those listed here are most likely to apply to the zoning boards. And the most common of these is legal consultation for current or likely litigation. So if someone appeals a zoning board decision after that decision has been made, the board may meet in closed session with their attorney to discuss how to defend their decision in court. Decisions to grant or deny a variance or a conditional use or appeal may not be decided in closed session. Ex parte communication. Zoning board members should not have conversations or have correspondence regarding a variance that's coming up or that's happened recently anytime except during a meeting or a hearing. Such outside contacts are known as ex parte communication, which means without the other party present. And if BOA members have these conversations inadvertently, maybe someone comes up to you in the grocery store and starts talking about their variance application, the BOA member should disclose that communication to state it during the meeting and make the information part of the record so it can be considered in the decision-making. The board as a whole can then determine the admissibility of the information, and individual members will determine its credibility and weight in deciding their decision. Okay, so now we jump into variances. Variances allow a landowner to do something prohibited by the zoning ordinance. So why do we have variances? Variances provide relief in limited and unusual circumstances. Variances can prevent a regulatory taking and provide a regulatory escape valve. Takings occur when government restrictions go so far as to allow no reasonable use of a property. Variances are not meant to provide general flexibility in ordinances, as this would result in losing the purposes of the zoning ordinance, such as protecting public safety. If they feel it's prudent, elected officials can revise the zoning ordinance, make an amendment to it, to incorporate the level of flexibility that the community supports. So why do our zoning board decisions matter? Let's try this analogy. If the purposes of a zoning ordinance are held in a bucket, then variances are granted, if variances are granted that don't meet the legal standards. They're like holes in the bucket, and the purposes of the ordinance, the water, leak out and are lost in that location or throughout that community. Now, a few examples. The purposes of a general zoning ordinance typically include protecting a community's health, safety, and welfare. Roadway setbacks protect the safety of drivers, passengers, and pedestrians by allowing people to see and react safely if someone is coming. These setbacks also allow for road widening and utility replacement. If variances are granted to roadway setbacks, they may result in more accidents and injuries and can increase costs for road widening and utility replacement. The photo shown here is from the rural area where I grew up. Both roads had speed limits of 55 miles an hour. When you came down Carver School Road here, from the bottom left of the photo to the stop sign right here, the only way to see left on Highway 20 was to pull a little bit into the highway so that you could see around this red home and garage that were built very close to the road. A driver died there, doing what I had done many times, pulling out into the road to see. A few years later, the house was bought and removed to make that intersection safer. So zoning board decisions do impact whether public safety is achieved in a community. Now an example from shoreland zoning. In Wisconsin, the navigable lakes and streams belong to all the people of Wisconsin. We all have the right to swim, boat, fish, and hunt on these waters. And shoreland zoning was adopted in the early 70s for the lands near our waters to protect our lakes and streams. Shoreland zoning does this by limiting hard surfaces like houses and driveways near the shore, as well as keeping shoreline trees and other deep-rooted plants in place to prevent water pollution and protect fish and spawning grounds. Granting variances to shoreland zoning standards, like for this house very close to the shore, allows shoreline tree removal and additional runoff, which results in more soil going into the water. That soil can suffocate the eggs of walleye and other fish, as well as degrade the water quality. Granting shoreland variances can reduce our protection of lakes and streams. And floodplain zoning. We have floodplain zoning in place to protect human life and health and minimize property damages and economic losses. Granting variances to floodplain zoning reduces the protection of human life and increases economic losses. Okay, so we said earlier, a variance allows a property owner to do something prohibited by the zoning ordinance. And under Wisconsin law, we have two potential types of variances. A use variance permits a landowner to put a property to an otherwise prohibited use. So it has the same end impact as a rezone, but it goes through a different process. An area variance allows modification of a physical, dimensional, or locational requirement, such as setback, front edge, height, bulk, or density. There are two potential problems with use variances. One is requests for use variances seldom qualify under the unnecessary hardship test, which for use variances is no reasonable use of the property if the use variance is not granted. Another difficulty is that use variances allow the zoning board, which are appointed officials, typically not elected officials, to essentially rezone the property. For instance, to allow an industry or a racetrack to locate in a residential zoning district in the course of one meeting. So for these reasons, many communities do not allow use variances, and they have not been overturned in court for making that decision of not allowing use variances. Okay, so for variances, the applicant has the burden of proof to show that these three statutory tests are met, that there's unnecessary hardship, that that unnecessary hardship is due to conditions unique to the property, and that the variance is not contrary to the public interest. These three standards apply to variances from all types of zoning, plus there are additional standards for floodplain zoning. If you would use the chat box and let me know, what do your local rules say about whether variance applications need to be complete before scheduling a hearing? Is there a requirement that they have to be complete? I see one person saying yes, yes. Yes, okay, required to be complete. Great, everyone who's weighing in says it is a requirement. This is what we recommend. Local rules such as the ordinance or the BOA bylaws, I recommend that you don't accept variance applications if the application is not complete, including if the applicant hasn't provided reasons that all of the variance tests are met. This saves everyone's time. It saves the BOA's time. It also saves the applicant's time. It's not helpful if you have variance requests going to the BOA and the owner or applicant has no explanation for how they meet one or more of the standards. Okay. So let's go through the three tests that come from statutes, recognizing that some communities may have additional variance standards as well, or tests. So conditions unique to the property. As shown here on the steep shoreline, in this case, all these properties have steep slopes. So having a steep slope wouldn't be unique. So conditions that are unique to the property can include steep slopes or wetlands, and not just that those exist on the property, but that they actually prevent compliance with the ordinance, that there isn't another place where the structure could be built. Conditions unique to the property. A few years ago, I sat in on a zoning board hearing where an applicant was applying for a variance to expand his boathouse larger than the ordinance allowed. After he presented his reasons, the zoning board let him know which of the three standards they felt were satisfied. They told him he had not convinced them that he had a hardship and asked him why he felt he needed a larger boathouse. He said, because I just bought a bigger boat that doesn't fit my boathouse. That's not a condition unique to the property. Circumstances of an applicant, such as a growing family or a need for a larger garage or a larger boathouse, are not a factor in deciding variances. Hardship is based on the circumstances of the property itself, not the circumstances of the owner. Another of the tests is the public interest test. A variance, if it's granted, may not harm the public interests. The public interests come from the purpose and intent of the ordinance. So if you go to the beginning of your ordinance, it will list the purpose and intent. Those were adopted by the elected officials representing the community. I recommend listing your ordinance purposes on your variance application form and on your variance decision form so that everyone can stay focused on what are we trying to accomplish with this ordinance? What are the purposes or the public interests? When deciding on variances, you should be considering the short-term impacts as well as the long-term and cumulative impacts of variance requests. And zoning staff can provide an impact analysis along those lines. And then the last of the three tests is unnecessary hardship. And here we're going to focus on area variances. Unnecessary hardship is present when compliance with the ordinance would unreasonably prevent the owner from using the property for a permitted purpose. For instance, if it's zoned residential, prevent a property owner from using it for a residential use. Or if it would be unnecessarily burdensome in view of ordinance purposes. So what does this phrase unnecessarily burdensome mean? The definition of unnecessary hardship is found in terms of unnecessarily burdensome, is found in this 1976 Snyder versus Waukesha County Zoning Board case. It was also confirmed later in follow-up cases. So the question here is, do porches or decks qualify for an unnecessary hardship? In this case, should an after-the-fact variance be granted for this red porch or deck because removing it would be an unnecessary hardship? The yellow dotted lines here show the required setbacks on this lot, and we have an existing home and garage and driveway. The Wisconsin Supreme Court came back on this. It was appealed all the way up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court and said, no, this variance should not be granted for two reasons. One is the hardship was self-created. The property owner built the deck without getting permits. And secondly, this porch here is no more than a personal convenience. And that's a phrase, this personal convenience, to keep in mind. When you're thinking about, does someone have unnecessary hardship? Is it truly a hardship to live without whatever they're proposing? Or is it a personal convenience to have that? The court went on to say, growth of a family and personal inconvenience do not constitute practical difficulties or unnecessary hardship, which justify a variance. It's not the uniqueness of the plight of the owner, but the uniqueness of the land, which is the criterion. Here are some other pieces from variance case law. We have self-created hardship. An applicant may not claim hardship because of conditions created by his or her actions. Loss of profit or financial difficulty do not constitute hardship. A zoning board may consider an error of local government staff when deciding whether to grant a variance. Lack of objections from neighbors doesn't justify a variance. Similarly, if there are structures that were built nearby that are ordinance violations, they were done illegally, that doesn't mean someone should get a variance to do the same thing. And we want to keep in mind that a variance runs with the property to all future property owners. So going back to this case where they built the porch that does not comply with the setback, I want to go through the rationale that the applicant provided and how the Supreme Court responded to that. The owner says that not having a deck will be an unnecessary hardship. Their first reason is the porch, which is substantially completed, would have to be removed. The court said self-created hardships don't count as hardships. The owner said the lot is substandard in size. It doesn't meet the size requirements. The court said this lot is treated the same as other substandard lots. It's not being singled out with different requirements. The property owner said the porch couldn't be attached to other sides of the home, that this is the most logical place to put it. The court said the porch may not be feasible at all on this property. There's no guarantee to having a porch. The owner says they need the porch to enjoy lake living for his family, including six children. The courts came back and said hardship has to be based on the property, not the applicant and the size of their family. And lastly, the applicant said that this porch would add to the value of the house. And the court came back and said loss of profit does not constitute hardship. Okay, so there's a little view of what the Supreme Court has said on variance cases in the past. So I have a poll for you here, which means I need to launch it. And that is, if there were 10 nearby neighbors come to a variance hearing and they all state their opinion that the proposed variance is fine, is this sufficient reason to grant the variance, that the neighbors are fine with it? So if you want to vote on this. Oh, we have lots of people voting quickly. Okay, you're fairly unanimous, I would say. We've got 80 people who have voted that that's not sufficient. It says no section for opinions in the zoning ordinance. I see typed in the chat box, as well as no, but our planning board seems to be influenced by it. Yes, I understand that can happen. I'm gonna do a related poll here now. Let's say those 10 nearby neighbors come to the variance hearing and they all state concerns with the proposed variance. And let's say they have concerns and they're against it. Is that sufficient reason to deny the variance? Everybody has concerns. They don't like it. Okay, this time it looks like we have some split. The majority are saying no, that's not a sufficient reason to deny the variance. But a few people are also saying yes, it is sufficient reason. Okay, I'm gonna end this poll. Okay, so variances, like we've talked about, are quasi-judicial decisions. They're not popularity contests. The variance can only be granted if the applicant shows that they meet all of the variance standards. The zoning board should definitely consider all the evidence provided by the neighbors and how it relates to the variance standards and whether the applicant provides evidence that they meet the standards. The BOA may need to weigh competing evidence. The BOA can't deny the variance based only on the opinions of the neighbors, but they could deny it if the neighbors provide evidence that the standards are not being met. All right, great. Okay, so sometimes I'm asked, you talk about what isn't unnecessary hardship. Well, what is an unnecessary hardship? And here are a few possibilities. One is if this happens probably more up north and where there are cottages and cabins, but homes that don't currently have an indoor bathroom, and if it would require a variance to make that addition to include an indoor bathroom, that would it probably in many cases qualify as an unnecessary hardship. Another example is lots that are zoned for residential use, but the setbacks don't leave room for a small home. So as shown here on the left, if the building envelope that's left after you apply the setbacks is 10 feet by 20 feet, it may be that there's reason to allow a variance to allow a slightly larger home there. You're going to have a stronger case that you have hardship in that situation if a driveway or a septic permit was already granted for that property, basically leading a property owner to believe that they get to develop that property. And then also, I just wanted to mention that in order to grant a floodplain variance, there are a number of other standards that have to be met in addition to the three that we talked about earlier. So we do have a separate floodplain variance application that's on the additional resources page that you can look at. Okay, so just to summarize, a variance can only be granted if the applicant has shown their property meets all three tests. Unnecessary hardship, the hardship is due to conditions unique to the property, and it's not contrary to the public interest or the purpose and intent of the ordinance. For county zoning, recommendations for town and the DNR should provide reasons that these three legal standards are met or are not met, because those are the standards that the BOA is required to use. One other tip is the BOA is not in the role of providing applicants with the reason the tests are met. That's really up to the applicant to provide the reasons that these tests are met.
Lynn, I have a question before you move on from the slide. For a general zoning ordinance, we've established that there's these three standards that you see in front of you. However, oftentimes when I look at local ordinances or application forms for a variance, I find that there's more than these three standards. For example, maybe they'll include things like hardship cannot be self-created. Is it okay to have these additional standards, and where do they typically come from?
Sure. Yes, it's fine to have additional variance standards that are based on the case law in order to break out specific legal points, such as whether a hardship is self-created or whether it's based on circumstances of an applicant rather than the property. Communities can also choose to have additional variance standards based on the purpose and intent statements in their ordinance. Oh, and then my last point is I have observed some places where the zoning hearing kind of becomes like a horse trading. If we do this and that, then can we have our variance? And that's not the intent of the variance process. It's are these three or four or five, however many are included, variance standards met or not met? Okay, so into the decision making. The decision has to include three parts. The first is the findings of fact. So the findings of fact include whether the BOA has the authority to make the decision, the facts from the record and the hearing form as to whether each of the standards is met, and determining whether the application contains all the information necessary to make the decision. Zoning staff should present their staff report. The report should contain the facts relevant to each variance standard. It may also contain whether staff feel that those legal standards, the variance standards, are met or not. After the variance hearing is closed, there shouldn't be more input from the applicant while the BOA is deliberating. The applicant has their opportunity to provide their evidence during the hearing portion. The decision also has to include the conclusions of law. So first you would specify the legal standards, such as the variance standards. Determine which facts relate to the legal standards, determine whether each of the variance standards is met, and provide the reasons that each standard was met or not met. This court case, Lamar, said it's not sufficient to simply say the standards are met or the standards are not met. And then if all the variance standards are met, agree on any permit conditions. And then the last part of the decision is the order and determination, deciding, voting on the situation, whether to grant the variance, and then directing the zoning administrator to take any necessary action.
Lynn, one more question before you move on from the slide. Can you attach conditions to a variance, or can you place time limits on a variance? And if so, how would you do this?
Sure. Yes, you can attach conditions to a variance. And this would be done by listing the conditions on the variance decision form. To ensure that future property owners will know about the conditions, I also recommend attaching them to the deed via an affidavit. So if a title search is done, they come up. You cannot place time limits on a variance because variances run with the land to all future property owners. So that's something to keep in mind when deciding it. But there is an option, and I recommend it, that once a variance is granted, you can place limits on the amount of time that the property owner has to start or complete their building project. 1 or 2 years is a typical time frame allowed for building by a variance. And the idea by putting that time frame on is that that variance, if it's not acted upon, is not still valid 10 years later when the neighborhood may have changed significantly, and therefore the impacts of that variance could have a different impact on the neighbors there. Okay, this is a recommended decision-making process for deciding on variances. To hand out a decision form to each BOA member ahead of the hearing, listen and take notes during the hearing, thinking about whether the applicant is meeting the variance standards. After the hearing, each BOA member fills out the decision form individually, providing the reasons that each legal standard is or is not met. BOA members then come together and each member shares the reasons they feel the variance standards are or are not met with the other BOA members. The BOA members can ask questions of each other and revise their forms, but it's not meant to be a debate. It's just meant to be a sharing session in terms of what each board member feels. And then it's time for a motion and a vote. And a motion to grant a variance can only be made if the applicant has met all of the variance standards. Okay, so now I'm gonna give you a practice session. The question is whether you would grant this after the fact variance. So the owner built an additional, a second garage and a pad leading from that garage. Leading to that garage. The roadway setbacks in the ordinance require that from County A down here, that there's 150-foot setback from the center line or 100 feet from the right of way, whichever is greater. And this property owner built the garage 76 feet back from the right of way instead of 100. From this secondary road, Horizon Lane over here, the setback requirements are 75 feet from the center line or 50 feet from the right of way, whichever is greater. And the garage is 34 feet from the right of way. The area east of the house has the septic and the well. The area west of the garage has underground utilities. There's natural gas and electric lines running here. So that's the situation. And so then the question is going to be, you know, whether each of the standards is met. And so I think we'll just move into that in our polling mode.
First question, as Lynn is launching this, is the unnecessary hardship test met? You can answer yes or no. And then if you have some reasons that you'd like to share with the group, you can use the chat box to answer that question as well.
Okay, so it looks like the majority of people say no, the unnecessary hardship test is not met. So let's see, how far does the property go to the rear? Very good question. When I look that up, I don't remember the exact depth of the lot, but it's a 5.26 acre lot. So it goes probably a ways back as well as a ways to the east. They could have potentially built to the rear of the home. This is a self-created hardship. I see someone typed in. Is this a county board member by chance asking for a friend? Don't think it passes the test of not being self-imposed, and they still have room for a garage that complies. They can still use the lot for its purposes. No, they don't meet the hardship. There would have been room in other areas of the lot. Okay, great. So I will end that poll. And move to the next one. Is the unique property limitations test met? Okay. What do you see unique on this property in terms of the physical property, or do you see anything? And again, if you would use the chat box to tell me why you're voting the way you are, either there is a unique property limitation or there is not. The well is too close to the septic. I noticed that as well. Yes. The rear yard is open. There's other buildable area. How about the question of, is everyone entitled to a second garage? Is there anything saying that living without a second garage is an unnecessary hardship? Okay, so I think we're fairly unanimous here. A second garage is not a hardship, someone wrote. Maybe, it depends on other conditions of the property. I was asked a little bit about this situation. Like I said, I looked up the parcel and found it listed as over 5 acres. I didn't see any wetlands or steep slopes, which could be unique property limitations if they prevent compliance in building along with the ordinance standards. While there may be reasons that the owner prefers to have the second garage where they put it, there are clearly many other alternative locations like you've brought up. Therefore, the unique property limitations test is not met. I think in many cases, this was probably more of a, we have more stuff. I have not found any case law, certainly, that says a second garage is necessary. But I haven't found any case law saying that a first garage is necessary. I see someone typed in the chat box, second garage equals personal convenience. And I think that's a very good summary of this. Okay, how about, is the no harm to the public interest test met? And here on this slide, I typed out the ordinance purpose and intent so you can look specifically at what a community had in mind. We're gonna say this was in Mud County. What are they trying to accomplish with their ordinance? Because remember that the purpose statements are what this is based on. And sorry, let me get that poll up. Whoops.
And I just launched that one for you.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, we have quite a few people saying the harm to the public interest test is not met. A few people saying they feel it is met. If you would type the reasons you feel it's met or not met in the chat box, that would help us understand what you're thinking. So for those of you that are saying the no harm to the public interest test is not met, what parts of the ordinance purpose do you feel are not met if this variance is granted? Setbacks are created for good reasons. Mud County. Yeah, I made up Mud County. Not enough information. Road visibility, yes. Right. I see, refers to highways and encroaching uses. So this would be an encroaching use. And here in the ordinance purpose, it says to prevent highways from economic suffocation by encroaching uses. So this would be an encroaching use. Visual triangles, equal treatment. The setback not being met may impede the highway at some point in terms of widening or utilities. Yeah. Okay. Anticipate safety uses. Why aren't others bound to the law? Right, and that's another point that popped out for me is right here, like in most zoning ordinances, health, morals, safety, and general welfare, the safety piece could definitely be impacted by people building closer to the road than the setbacks allow. That's one of the main reasons, as well as keeping the highways functional for the future. Okay, so one more poll here. Thanks, Becky. Are all three of the variance tests met in this case? we can only grant the variance if all the tests are met. And it looks like you're fairly unanimous in terms of the people that have voted so far said no. Okay, so then there's a question that popped up in the chat box. So now, what happens to the building if this variance is not granted? It is not the role of the BOA to do enforcement if they choose to not grant a variance, like here where it wasn't, the standards were not met. Then it goes back to the zoning staff. And in the case of removal of a building, they would typically work with the corporation council in order to move this forward and go to the judge if the property owner doesn't remove it on their own. Yeah. There is some discretion in terms of whether that building has to be taken down, but typically something that's clearly not meeting the standards, not meeting the ordinance standards, and not meeting the variance standards, it does have to be removed. There's a case from Washera County from many years ago where that's exactly what happened, only it wasn't a garage, it was a home. That was removed because in that case, it was a shoreline setback of 75 feet. And if I remember right, it was built at around 60 feet. And the judge said, there's no way you can argue this was, you know, mismeasured, that it was just an accident. This was clearly done on purpose. For a township, what is the equivalent of a corporation council? Yeah, good question. So that would be the town attorney. At the city level, it would be the city attorney, right? Okay, thanks. Okay, we have 5 minutes left. So like we talked about earlier, like court decisions, zoning board decisions can be appealed to the courts. When they do go to the courts, these are the standards that the courts use in measuring up the BOA decision. Was it a decision that should be made by the BOA? Did the BOA follow proper procedures, such as public notice, the public hearing, and open meeting? Were the correct standards used? So the variance standards that are listed in your ordinance, which are based on state statutes and may also include the case law. And could a reasonable person reach the same conclusion? And then the last one is evidence. Are the facts that are referred to included in the record that goes up to the judge? A court can reverse, affirm, or modify a decision in whole or in part. And an overturned decision is typically remanded to the BOA with directions to decide it consistent with the court's findings. Okay, so in a short period of time, I'm going to go through a few process things and just give you a few ideas. I think having a clear process can be very helpful for the applicants and the staff in the variance process. So I just want to point to a couple of websites. The websites provide the first impression and direct the user to information. So you can see this website has a flowchart, procedures, application fee, application form, and more information under variances. You can see a different website from City of Platteville. The variance process is laid out here so that someone who wants to apply for a variance knows very clearly what the steps are. Notice there's this pre-application staff meeting. It's not required, but recommended. I think that's really helpful with variances because I think that these variance standards, what case law says unnecessary hardship means, isn't necessarily what the general public understands unnecessary hardship to mean until it's explained. In the application packet that an applicant would receive, it's good to have this information on what are the steps, what is the process. I also recommend some version of an announcement at the beginning of zoning board meetings explaining how does the zoning board function? They have to follow the laws. They have to make their decisions based on whether the variance standards are met. So it's good for the applicant to know that at the beginning as part of their application packet. It's also good for everyone who comes to the variance hearing to know that that's how the zoning board functions. That's included on the resources page, as are all these examples. We want to have an application form that includes the ordinance purpose here at the top, so we know what the purpose of the ordinance is. That obviously relates to public interest. And also it prompts the applicant to provide their reasons for why each variance standard is or is not met. This is from Iowa County. I think it's a good idea as well. They have a summary of variance case law showing relevant pieces that apply to an applicant. These can either be offered like this as a separate piece, or they can be woven into the descriptions for, you know, what is your hardship, for instance, and stating that it can't be a self-created hardship. We've got the decision packet, which is for the zoning board members, but it can also be for the applicant and any interested parties. In the staff report, staff can provide additional facts, analysis of those facts related to the variance standards, and recommendations on whether the variance standards are or are not met.
And I do have one question here, because I work with a lot of communities that don't have staff dedicated to zoning. Towns, small villages, et cetera. Do you recommend that they work with a consultant or an attorney, or do you have other tips for these small communities?
Sure, great question. I suggest that the small communities have someone who's familiar with zoning to write those staff reports and probably sit in on the zoning board meetings as well, like staff normally would. In most cases, I don't think it needs to be an attorney. Though that would be advisable on very controversial issues where you expect to have many people there testifying. Options for a consultant who could write staff reports and help the BOA include if you're a town or a small village, you may be able to hire county zoning staff that would be paid a fee to administer zoning. Also, sometimes regional planning commissions have staff that could, again, be hired for a fee for this, as well as private consultants. And I think taking time to develop good forms and processes and the informational materials that go with them, like shown here, goes a long way toward the process going smoothly. Then you want to have your decision form for the Board of Adjustment or Board of Appeals, where again, they're going to record their facts and how those line up in terms of which standard are they related to. Some of them may not be related to any. And then what is that decision? Are those standards met? And so is it granted or denied? If it's granted, then what are the conditions? Are there any conditions that would be applied? The resources webpage also includes a separate decision form, again, for floodplain variances. And when you have towns that are providing variance recommendations to county boards of adjustment, this same form, the same one that the county BOA uses, could be used for the town so that you're prompting them to provide evidence related to the standards, not simply an opinion of whether they're for or against it. So just summarizing the different roles, the elected officials adopt the zoning ordinance, amend the zoning ordinance, whereas the BOA members act like judges and apply the ordinance and the state laws as they're currently written. We do have the zoning board handbook that's available online. You can also order hard copies from our website. We also have the land use training page, resources page. On that, we have a section related to zoning board training that includes short videos as well as these decision forms. And then we just wanted to do a final poll, and that is what you plan to do with the information from today. Do you plan to take any of these actions, or are there other things that you plan to do? If there are other things, you could plug those into the chat box. Looks like review and update our application materials is in the lead. Other things popping up along the way. Okay. This looks great. I'll leave that open for a little bit so everybody can get their responses in. And looks like we're at 11:02, so a little bit over, but I am happy to stay for a while and answer questions. You can put your questions in the chat box or you can raise your hand and we can call on you to do it. Raising the hand, actually I may not have instructions for that, but I trust many of you know how to go about that. Okay.
So just a reminder for everyone to visit the resource webpage that's associated with this webinar. We've already posted the PowerPoint. We've posted many of the forms and other resources that Lynn talked about. And within a day or two, we will also be posting a video recording of the presentation as well. In the meantime, if you have any questions, put those in the chat box. Feel free to reach out to any of us after the webinar as well if something pops into your mind afterwards. Lynn, we did get one question earlier in the presentation. It was when you were talking about the two poles, about you were describing the three standards for granting a variance, and you asked if we should grant the variance over the objections of neighbors. So one of the chat participants asked about, what about concerns with substantial evidence? Do you want to describe where that comes from, that new language? Otherwise, I'd be happy to take that one on as well.
Sure, I'll start and you can add to it, Becky.
Absolutely.
So substantial evidence was defined in Wisconsin statutes in regards to conditional uses by the 2017 Act 67. And I don't remember the exact definition, but it's that substantial evidence should be facts, not just opinion. No one has said to date that the substantial evidence standard applies to variances. But because variance standards are specified in state statute, and there may be additional variance standards, you want to stick with those standards. And part of substantial evidence is weighing evidence, thinking about the credibility of that evidence. And that applies to variances just like it applies to conditional uses. Someone coming and saying, you know, this will happen if you grant the variance. If that person has no background in that area, let's say it's it will flood out the neighbor. If that's just an opinion, and that person doesn't have a background in that, that's not great evidence. If they have photos of that area being flooded in the past and adding impervious or hard surfaces is going to increase that, that would be stronger evidence. If there was actually a study done looking at that, that would be even stronger evidence. Did you want to add to that, Becky?
I do have the definition in front of me, so I'll add that for anyone Great. Who's interested. So substantial evidence means, and this is now defined in state statutes for conditional uses, it means facts and information other than merely personal preferences or speculation directly pertaining to the requirements and conditions an applicant must meet to obtain a conditional use permit, and that reasonable persons would accept in support of the conclusion. So I agree with Lynn. I think that's an excellent standard to hold yourself to when you're looking at variances. It's not merely personal opinion. You can consider that information that comes before you as long as it's related to those variance standards.
Mm-hmm. I would also say that if you have people providing studies of some sort of impact as a result that they expect as a result of a variance granting, it's important to look at those studies and see if they actually seem relevant for this situation. I know some of our counties have been having more studies presented, and they've decided that some of those studies aren't relevant to the situation at hand.
So another question that just came in, is there a site that shows the most recent court findings on Wisconsin statutes related to zoning?
Right. So the best site that I have to recommend is the Wisconsin APA site. Has a tab. Maybe Becky, you remember what the tab is. It's like
for something called legal
legislation and case law, yes, or something like that. And there, Brian Ohm, who's a land use attorney down at UW-Madison, who also works for Extension, he posts monthly reports on that. It's not the easiest to search, but if you read it on a monthly basis, it's fairly quick to keep an eye
on. Other place to find information, it's not, I'm not sure how quickly it's updated. If you look at the footnotes in statutes as well, they will also post relevant information that applies statewide.
Yeah. There's also a document on zoning case laws that applies to shoreland zoning. It hasn't been updated in a number of years, but it's on the DNR Shoreland Zoning website if you're interested in that. Okay.
I'm not seeing any additional questions.
All righty. Thank you everyone for joining us today.
Actually, there is one more question. What is the definition of a reasonable person?
I don't think I'll try to answer that. I think there are lots of opinions on that. No, I will take a shot at it. A reasonable person. I think it's just that a logical argument can be made based on the facts that are presented in a given variance hearing, that you could use those facts to reach whatever conclusion it is that you have, that this, you know, maybe that all three variance standards are met, or maybe that, you know, two are met and one is not met. So it's just that there's a logical link between the standards, or I'm sorry, between the evidence and the decision.
One way I like to think about it, it's not this necessarily how the judge would decide in that case. It's not what his or her personal opinion is, but it's whether he or she could support your rationale or the rationale of the person who's providing that information, mm-hmm, just like Lynn said.
Yeah. All right. Thank you everyone for joining us today. I hope you found it useful.
Thank you.
Have a good day.